Murder, romance, scandal. That's my kind of mystery. Dispatch by Breakout Games delivers all that and more straight to your home. Told through clues you receive in the mail, the story draws you in to solve a crime over several months of interactive investigation. I've been playing with my fiancé, and trust me, this is pure crime-solving gold. The perfect thing to do on a Friday or Saturday night. Intrigued? Satisfy your curious mind with 50% off your first delivery. Go to breakoutdispatch.com/court and use code court to subscribe today. That's breakoutdispatch.com/court and use the code court. At 10 a.m. on October 24th, 2014, reporters, spectators, and people close to the case gathered at the Okfuskee County Courthouse in Okemah, Oklahoma. Kevin Sweat was about to be sentenced on 3 counts of murder, and 3 families were about to finally feel some sort of reassurance that the killer of their loved ones would hopefully be ordered to never walk the streets again. It's not necessarily unusual for a court proceeding to run a little behind schedule, but as the minutes ticked by, people started wondering when the sentencing would begin. Then, at 10:10 a.m., a frantic burst of activity. Reporters noticed deputies sprinting towards the judge's chambers. Something unexpected had taken place. And then, the courtroom went on lockdown. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 42. Today, I'm covering a horrifying case that involves a 23-year-old missing woman, the tragic death of 2 little girls, and a suspect so dangerous that even his own attorney wasn't safe. ...25-year-old Kevin Sweat apparently liked to tell stories. This particular one about his missing girlfriend. On July 30th, 2011, police in Okmulgee, Oklahoma interviewed Kevin about when he last saw his girlfriend, 23-year-old Ashley Taylor. Ashley's mom had called them to report her daughter missing the day before, saying that she had last spoken to Ashley about 2 weeks prior, on July 15th. When Ashley had told her that she and her boyfriend, Kevin, were going to go to Louisiana and get married. She told her mom she would be back by July 29th. But when Ashley's mom didn't hear from her after she was supposed to get married and after she missed her brother's birthday, she became concerned and called the police. As Kevin sat in the interrogation room, he told investigators that on the morning of July 17th, he and Ashley were driving to Louisiana when they got into an argument. He said he pulled over onto the shoulder of Highway 75 between Okmulgee and Schulter, and Ashley got out of the car. He said that was the last time he ever saw her. 3 days later, when police interviewed him again, Kevin expanded on his story. He said that after Ashley got out of his car that day, he then drove to Nichols Park in Henrietta, Oklahoma, and stayed there until 12 p.m., He said he then drove to his father's house near Waletka, where he built a fire on the north side of the house. He told the officers that he burned notebooks and videotapes in the fire and that he stayed at his dad's house until 3 p.m. He then drove home, and he hadn't seen Ashley since that day. That was Kevin's first version. The next day, on August 3rd, agents from the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigations, or OSBI, interviewed him. And this time, Kevin had a different story to tell about his missing girlfriend. He told them that on the morning of July 17th, he and Ashley left their apartment in Okmulgee and drove to Nichols Park in Henrietta. He told Ashley he wasn't going to marry her, and they got into an argument, which then turned physical. He said Ashley hit him, and so he pulled a knife out of his pocket. He threw the knife at her, and the knife hit her in the face. He then asked her, "Why don't you kill yourself?" Ashley then picked up the knife and walked to the pier at the lake, with Kevin following close behind. She cut herself with the knife and then fell on the pier. Kevin described how he picked the knife up and then proceeded to cut her throat. He said she was still alive when he cut her. He then pushed her into the lake and she didn't come back up out of the water, and so he walked back to his car and left. The next day, investigators conducted an extensive search at that lake and pier where Kevin said the incident had occurred, but they didn't find Ashley's body or any evidence that the two had even been there. In the following days, investigators went to Kevin's father's property near Waleka, where Kevin had initially said he had gone after last seeing Ashley. And sure enough, investigators found what they were looking for. They recovered several human bone fragments and personal property that looked like it belonged to Ashley from a burn pile at the side of the house. Kevin was arrested and charged with Ashley's murder. Kevin Joe Sweat was born in Okmulgee, Oklahoma on January 27, 1986, to Pat and Deborah Sweat. He was the youngest of three boys, although he and his brothers reportedly weren't very close due to a substantial age difference. Their mom worked in food services, and their father worked at a glass company in Henrietta, Oklahoma. Kevin was reportedly bullied in high school and was even once suspended for getting into a fight. But he didn't have much of a criminal record before being arrested for Ashley's murder. He had no juvenile record, but in 2009, he was charged with possession of a controlled substance and possession of drug paraphernalia. He worked at a number of fast food restaurants, including McDonald's and Subway, and he was in the U.S. Naval Reserves for 3 years. Ashley Celeste Taylor was born on November 8, 1987, one of three children to Michael and Patricia Taylor. Kevin reportedly met Ashley in late 2007 or early 2008 while taking a class together in school. And Ashley's parents would later tell reporters that they liked Kevin when they first met him. He told them that he was former military and that he wanted to be a police officer. But he also talked about his affinity for guns. As time went on, Ashley's relationship with Kevin progressed. And within 2 years, they were living together and engaged. Ashley's parents told a contributor with Forbes that she seemed like a different person and that she and Kevin argued often. Kevin kept an online journal around this time, and in May 2010, he wrote, "I got engaged not too long ago. Biggest mistake of my life. Wish I knew she was a complete basket case, medicated and suicidal before I got with her. Now I'm kind of stuck, but no worries yet. I'm saving up money so I can finally leave Oklahoma once and for all." But if Kevin wanted out of his relationship, it seems that no one, including Ashley, knew. Ashley's mom recounted for the contributor at Forbes her last encounter with her daughter, saying that Ashley had first called her on July 5th, saying that she needed her birth certificate, that she and Kevin were planning on eloping, and that she was, quote, so happy. Later that day, she met up with the soon-to-be-married couple, and she noticed that something didn't seem right with her daughter. That was the last time she saw her. After Ashley was reported missing, her parents had tried to get a hold of Kevin, but his phone, along with Ashley's, was disconnected. So they went to Kevin and Ashley's apartment and were able to catch Kevin in the parking lot, attempting to leave. They started asking him questions about where their daughter was, and, much to their surprise, he blurted out, "I suppose I'm going to get blamed for this like I did the little Waleka girls." Kevin then told them that he had also been extensively questioned by police in connection with a murder that had occurred 3 years earlier in Waleka, Oklahoma. See, what no one else knew at the time was that Kevin was hiding an even darker secret. It was a crime that was unthinkable, the kind of crime that makes your insides hurt and leaves you searching for some sort of understanding, a reason as to why something so horrible could have happened. That is certainly how the small community of Waleka, Oklahoma, located just 90 miles east of Oklahoma City, felt in the summer of 2008, 3 years prior to the disappearance of Ashley Taylor. It was Sunday, June 8th, about 5:20 in the afternoon. The grandfather of 13-year-old Taylor Placker was out searching for his granddaughter and her friend, 11-year-old Skyla Whitaker. Taylor and Skyla had left their homes earlier that afternoon to go for a walk to a bridge nearby to play and look for frogs. But they hadn't yet returned, and their families were getting worried. When Taylor's grandfather got just a half mile away from Taylor's home, he made an awful and unexpected discovery. Taylor was lying in the ditch, and Skyla was lying on a hill along North 3890 Road, both fully clothed in their t-shirts and shorts. At first, Taylor's grandfather believed that they had been hit by a car, but as he got closer, he could tell that something more sinister had happened to the two young girls. They had both been shot multiple times. Police immediately responded to the area and found five shell casings and tire tracks at the scene. They were able to preserve them before the heavy rain set in. The next day, autopsies were performed by the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in Oklahoma City. According to the autopsy report, Skyla had been shot 8 times in the neck, arms, shoulders, chest, and abdomen, and Taylor was shot 5 times in the face, groin, and hand. There were no signs of any sexual assault. The projectiles collected from the bodies were from 2 different guns, a .40 caliber weapon and a .22 caliber, suggesting that there may have been 2 shooters. The small community of Waletka was stunned at the news. As the girls were buried, police released a sketch of a person of interest. They said he was about 35 years old, 6 feet tall, American Indian, with black hair and a ponytail. He was reportedly seen standing near a white pickup truck with a chrome stripe around the time the two girls were killed and in the same vicinity. But the girls' murders would stump law enforcement for the next couple of years. In January 2010, OSBI agents received information that a man named Kevin Sweat had purchased a Glock 40 caliber handgun in the fall of 2007. He had been living in Henrietta, Oklahoma, just over 16 miles away from Waletka when the crime occurred. So OSBI agent Kurt Titsworth went to interview Kevin about the gun he had bought. Kevin told him that he had indeed owned that gun, but that he had sold it in 2007 and didn't know what the serial number was. And so investigators continued on with their investigation. On the 2-year anniversary, investigators held a press conference in the exact spot where the girls had been killed, where they appealed to anyone who had any information to contact them, and they tried to reassure everyone that the case was still very active.
Thank you for being here today. I asked you guys to come out here to the memorial site because I knew you would come out here anyway, and it's just appropriate that we revisit the place where the two girls lost their lives 2 years ago today. As I've told many of you, this is still an open and very active case. We have an agent who works on it almost every day, and that's very good because a case is not cold until we get no leads, and this is a very active case. We have several suspects we're looking at, we're focusing on right now. Of course, we've made no arrest. When we do, I'll give you guys a call, of course, and we hope that will be very soon, but we are working very hard on it.
Peter Placker, Taylor's grandfather, who had first discovered the girls' bodies, also spoke at the press conference.
It's hard for me to even be here. We need this thing solved. Somebody knows something, they come up and say something about it. They don't even have to say who they are. But it helped both our families get over this. It's been 2 years now. They've been out there 2 years too long.
He became too upset to finish his sentence. After Peter spoke, District Attorney Max Cook then addressed the audience, and he said that there was an award of over $160,000 for information leading to an arrest. But their big break in the case wouldn't come until an arrest was made in the disappearance and murder of Ashley Taylor. We'll get into more of that right after this quick break from today's sponsors. If you're like me, your favorite part of going to the mall as a kid was stopping by Mrs. Fields. It made all that shopping you were forced to do completely worthwhile. It'll probably be your favorite part of going holiday shopping this year, too. Something about that first soft bite of the perfect chocolate chip cookie just makes you feel like a kid again. Well, this holiday season, you can give your friends and family that same feeling of pure joy with a holiday gift arrangement from Mrs. Fields. Mrs. Fields cookies have been around for 40 years. Everyone knows them and loves them. Remember the first time you had one? It's like you finally knew what a chocolate chip cookie should taste like. And no other cookies are ever quite really the same. I have so many favorite cookies from Mrs. Fields, and now I have a delicious box of them sitting on my kitchen counter that I just cannot stop eating. I struggle with which ones are my favorite, but you can't go wrong with their chocolate chip or their chewy peanut butter cookies. They're so soft and chocolatey, and just thinking about those cookies makes my mouth water. And Mrs. Fields cookies are freshly baked and ready to enjoy right out of the box, so everyone can have what they've always wanted right now. And I have an exclusive deal for my listeners. Go to mrsfields.com, click on the microphone on the upper right-hand corner, and enter the code JUNKIE to save 20% on any Mrs. Fields product, including their best-selling Peace, Love, and Cookies tin, which comes with holiday favorites like Nibblers bite-sized cookies, brownie bites, and more. I'm not kidding. This is the perfect gift. Just click on the microphone and enter promo code JUNKIE to get 20% off site-wide at mrsfields.com. That's mrsfields.com. Use code JUNKIE. This episode is also sponsored by Warby Parker, a new concept in eyewear, contemporary eyeglasses that are extremely affordable and fashion-forward. Glasses should be viewed as a fashion accessory, but they should not cost as much as a plane ticket or a new iPhone. I think we can all agree on that. Warby Parker is awesome. Glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. Lenses include anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings. And the best part, at least in my opinion, is that for every pair you buy, a pair is then distributed to someone in need. And check this out. Warby Parker makes buying glasses online easy and risk-free. They have a home try-on program that allows you to order 5 pairs of glasses and have them shipped directly to your door, where you can try them on in the comfort of your own home and get feedback from friends, family, colleagues, the mailman, everyone whose opinion you care about. You can try the frames for 5 days before sending them back using a free prepaid return shipping label with no obligation to purchase. It's 100% free, and it's so easy, my dog Porky could do it. I've been using Warby Parker for years now, even before they sponsored Court Junkie. I've ordered 2 pairs of eyeglasses from them so far, and the process could not have been easier. I chose 5 frames from their website that I wanted to try. They immediately sent them to me. I tried them on and picked out which one I wanted, sent them back, and then went online to order them. They have this really cool measuring system, so they send you the exact frames you need. And they'll even take care of contacting your eye doctor and having your eyeglass prescription added to your order. You never even have to leave your house. It's great. So head on over to warbyparker.com/court to order your free home try-ons today. Choose the 5 frames you'd like to try on, mail the frames back, choose your favorite pair to have your prescription added to, and order. Warby Parker makes your experience completely risk-free and free shipping all around. Visit warbyparker.com/court to begin your free home try-on experience today. Have an iPhone X? Make sure to download Warby Parker's app, where you can use their brand new feature, Find Your Fit. Find Your Fit uses the iPhone X's True Depth camera to map and measure key facial features. And then using these measurements, Find Your Fit recommends approximately 12 Warby Parker frames that are likely the best fit for your face. The process is seamless and only takes a few seconds. Visit warbyparker.com/court. And now, back to the episode. After Kevin was arrested for Ashley's murder, Ashley's father recounted to the OSBI what Kevin had said to them about having been questioned in Taylor and Skyla's murders. He insisted that they get involved in the case, and they did. OSBI agents went to Kevin's father's property. Kevin's father told them that there was an area on the property where Kevin used to shoot his guns. As they searched that area, they came across several .40 caliber shell casings. The casings were sent to the OSBI Forensic Science Center for analysis and were determined to have been fired from the same gun as the ones found at the scene of the girls' shooting. They had found their man. On September 13, 2011, OSBI agent Kurt Titsworth interviewed Kevin about the girls' homicides. He was read his rights, and Kevin agreed to make a statement. This is what Kevin told them. On the afternoon of June 8, 2008, Kevin was driving his black Chevrolet Cavalier on North 3890 Road. He pulled over to the side of the road and saw, quote, two monsters coming at him. He said he panicked, and so he grabbed his Glock 40 caliber handgun from between the seats of the car. He pointed the gun at the monsters and shot them. He then grabbed a .22 caliber gun he had in the glove box and shot the monsters again, this time with a .22 caliber gun. He then got into his car and left. In December 2011, Kevin was officially charged with the girls' murders, in addition to Ashley's.
Thank you all for being here today. A short time ago, the Okefenokee County District Attorney's Office filed first-degree murder charges related to the deaths of 13-year-old Taylor Placker and 11-year-old Skylar Whitaker. On June 8, 2008, these two young, precious girls were shot multiple times on the side of a dirt road in rural Okefenokee County near Weleka. The Okefenokee County Sheriff's Office responded to the scene and called the OSBI for investigative assistance in this horrific and evil crime. Over the past 3.5 years, the OSBI staff has conducted nearly 650 interviews, ran over 900 leads in this case. This investigation took us to locations throughout Oklahoma, and it took us to points outside of our state. It's also important to note that this case is not closed for the OSBI. Agents will continue to work for many months as we now prepare to present this case in a court of law. The subject being charged with this murder is 25-year-old Kevin Sweat of Henrietta, Oklahoma. Also today, we're releasing a booking photograph of Mr. Sweat. It was taken several months ago when he was arrested for the murder of Ashley Taylor, his girlfriend. We also are releasing a second photo of Mr. Sweat, taken around the time that the murders occurred in 2008 near Weleka. We hope that by releasing that photo, it will spark someone's memory of seeing Mr. Sweat around the scene of the murder, which will help us establish the timeline surrounding that crime.
Prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty for the murders of Taylor and Skyla. At a preliminary hearing prior to going to trial for Ashley's murder, Okmulgee Police Officer Lyndon Spears testified that he made the first contact with Kevin after the missing persons report was filed. He said at first, Kevin gave him the story about Ashley having gotten out of his car by the side of the road as they were on their way to Louisiana. Kevin allowed him to search his car and his apartment. In the car, investigators found Ashley's wallet with her ID inside. There was also a large axe in the trunk. OSBI agent Kurt Titsworth testified that Kevin's father's property was in Weleka, and when it was searched, they found a pair of eyeglasses consistent with the kind that Ashley owned, as well as pieces of clothing and, quote, severely fragmented pieces of bone in a burn pile. He said the medical examiner was unable to positively confirm that the bones were Ashley's, but they were human and were likely female. Kevin's father, Curtis Sweat, took the stand and told the court that he didn't know that Kevin was engaged to Ashley, that he never really talked to him about it. He said that on July 17th, he saw that there had been a fire on his property, and there was a cup nearby with Kevin's initials on it. He said he called Kevin to, quote, chew him out for starting a fire because there was a burn barn. When he asked what he had been burning, Kevin told him that he had just burned some trash from his car. Later, Curtis testified that he found a small diamond ring in the ashes. He said he confronted Kevin about it, but he told him that it must have been with some of the things that he burned from his car. A few months after the hearing, prosecutors announced that they would also be seeking the death penalty in Ashley's murder. Kevin's attorneys requested that Kevin be tried on all three counts of murder, the murder of Ashley and the murders of Taylor and Skyla, at one time, and the judge granted that request. One of the key issues going into Kevin's trial was the issue of whether his interrogations with police would be admissible in court. The defense argued that Kevin wasn't able to give a, quote, knowing and intelligent waiver of his Miranda rights before he confessed. At another pretrial hearing, the defense presented a forensic psychologist who said that Kevin showed several problems with the way he processes information. He said that the investigators who read him his rights may have read them too quickly for Kevin to really understand them. He said Kevin would be able to understand them now, but that he wouldn't have back in 2011. He gave an example of Kevin misperceiving information, saying that when he asked Kevin why he gave differing accounts when interviewed by detectives, Kevin told him it was because the detectives had put poison in his soda. And another psychologist for the defense wrote in his report that Kevin may have even had autism or Asperger's. But prosecutors maintained that Kevin signed the proper waivers beforehand and that he knew what he was doing. They presented a forensic psychologist who said that while Kevin gave contradictory answers on some of his psychological tests he gave him, he found no evidence of mental confusion, illness, or deficiencies. He noted that Kevin repeatedly refused to answer basic questions about his personality that most defendants answer. The defense cross-examined this witness for more than 7 hours, but ultimately, the judge ruled to allow the interrogations in. In another preliminary hearing, Kevin waived his right to a jury trial in exchange for the state to drop the death penalty sentence. But just 4 days before he was set to go to trial, Kevin suddenly pleaded guilty to the murders of Ashley, Taylor, and Skyla. Prosecutors had filed new documents in the case, citing new evidence that they would be presenting at trial. And one of Kevin's attorneys said that this new evidence was a, quote, critical factor in Kevin's guilty plea. In a handwritten note presented to the court, Kevin wrote, quote, I would stipulate that I made statements to Kurt Titsworth on August 3rd, 2011 and September 13th, 2011, where I said that I killed Ashley Taylor, Skyla Whitaker, and Taylor Placker. I stipulate that those statements, the preliminary hearing testimony, and the witnesses and exhibits endorsed by the state prove guilt. By pleading guilty, that meant that Kevin would not be convicted as a result of a unanimous jury, which, under Oklahoma law, is the criteria for the death penalty. So he was now facing life in prison or life in prison without the possibility of parole. And what was that new evidence that prosecutors had discovered? Well, they may have come across an answer to what almost everybody who has ever heard about this case wanted to know, a motive for cold-heartedly shooting and killing those little girls. According to court documents, prosecutors said they had new witnesses they would call to the stand at trial who would testify that Kevin blamed the Placker family for his brother's death. Kevin's brother had died of a drug overdose back in 2007. Two of Kevin's former co-workers had given statements saying that Kevin told them that he didn't like the Placker family and that he believed that they had sold his brother bad drugs. And prosecutors had been planning on calling Christopher Placker, Taylor's brother, as a witness who would testify that in 2007, he did indeed sell drugs to Kevin's brother. But now, Kevin was going to be sentenced and the families would be spared a trial. I spoke with Liz Bryant, who was a reporter with KJRH in Tulsa, Oklahoma at the time. She had been following the case for years before becoming directly involved with it, in a way she never expected.
I had heard about the case many years prior because it was such a captivating case. I mean, these little girls died on the side of the road. They were shot. And then this woman who was a fiance of Kevin's was burned to death. She was incinerated in a fire. So it was a case that had really taken in our whole state because it was unbelievable. It was like, who did this? And why would you do something like this? And it was talked about for many, many years.
After Kevin pleaded guilty and confessed to the murders, Liz went to Kevin's family's home to see what they thought about Kevin's admission. But it didn't go exactly as she had planned. And afterwards, something bizarre started happening.
When I got involved, I was an NBC reporter in Tulsa, and I was assigned to go out to Kevin's family's home. I was supposed to go get their side. I was supposed to go get an interview with them because the time of events, at the time, Kevin had taken a plea deal with the FBI, and he wrote a statement that he was guilty of all three murders. So the two little girls and his fiance. And I believe the deal was in order for him to avoid the death penalty. So I was supposed to go out and talk to Kevin's family about how they felt, what they thought about their son, their uncle, their cousin saying he was guilty of three murders. And I gave one of the family members my card, my business card. And after that, I started getting phone calls from Kevin Sweat himself in jail. So his family member denied the interview. I didn't get any of the family to speak, but he passed along my number to Kevin in jail saying, if you would like to speak, then this reporter is looking for a statement. She is interested. And little did I know that that would start a chain of events of him calling me very frequently. Sometimes it was twice a day, sometimes it was every day, sometimes it was maybe once a week.
So Kevin himself started calling her. And so Liz started recording the phone calls.
My news director said, Liz, we have got to start recording these conversations because we didn't know if he was going to reveal something that we would be on the hook for knowing. You know, we didn't know what he was going to say or what he was capable of revealing. So my news director had me start recording the conversations, and we would just ask him, like, why did you kill this person? Did you kill this person? What happened? Why are you calling me? And I was told that he didn't just call me, but he also called an Oklahoma City reporter. But it was a really uneasy, unsettling time in my life, because here this guy was that said he was guilty or wrote a statement claiming his guilt of three murders, and then he's calling me.
Can you tell me, do you remember that first phone call and what that was like for you?
I don't remember what was said. I just remember answering the phone, and it was the recording. This is a call from the X fill in the blank jail. Would you like to accept this call? It is from, and then he inserted his voice. It was like, Kevin Sweat. And it was he has a really kind of high pitched voice. A high octave voice, but it's a very quiet, kind of low tone, but still kind of a high pitch at the same time. I know that sounds contradictory, but it just gave me the chills, like, instantly. I just thought to myself, is this a prank? Is this a joke? Like, Kevin Sweat is calling me from jail? And I was just instantly freaked out. And I don't remember that conversation. I mean, I'm sure I was just like, why are you calling me? And how did you get my number? And I think I was just in such shock. I didn't know what to do. And I called another reporter who had dealt with the case for many years before I did. And I called my boss and was like, you know, what do I do? Do I talk to him? Do I say, please don't call me? You know, I didn't know what to do. I just remember the feeling. I don't remember the conversation. I just will always remember the feeling.
And do you think he just wanted to talk to you about the case, or was he like trying to talk to you about like personal things too?
Yeah, he just wanted to talk to me about the case. Well, like I said, I would ask him questions like, did you kill this person? Did you kill this person? Did you kill this person? Why did you kill this person? What happened? What do you remember of it? And he would reveal stuff to me, like, for instance, his fiance's murder. If I can remember correctly, he just said to me, he just blacked out. Like, he remembers getting an argument with her, and then he just blacked out. And I remember him saying something about they were driving to Louisiana, and he pulled over on the side of the road and let her out because they got in a fight. And he didn't talk to me about anything personal. He would just wanted to talk about the case. And I think the theory was that he wanted to talk about the case because it was coming up to his time in front of the judge, which would be ultimately accepting his plea bargain, his plea deal, and then going to prison for the rest of his life.
On October 24th, 2014, the day of Kevin's sentencing, Liz went to the courthouse to cover the hearing.
The day of sentencing, I remember on the side of this courthouse, which it's in a really small town in Oklahoma. It's this beautiful courthouse, very historic courthouse made out of stone. And I remember on the side of the courthouse, there was just a bunch of black unmarked cars. And having a news background, that typically means undercover or DEA, FBI, some kind of federal agency. And there were a lot, many unmarked black SUVs. And then there were sheriff's deputies, highway patrol. There was a lot of police presence or law enforcement presence. And I remember them walking him in. He was wearing an orange jumpsuit. He had his glasses on. He's very small, scrawny guy. And he just has this aura about him and has this look about him that just kind of sets you back, like kind of takes you back and you're like, whoa, he just kind of gives you the goosebumps and you don't really know why. You can't explain it just when you look at someone.
Right. And then plus he was calling you too at that time, right?
Exactly. And so they took him upstairs on, I believe it was the second floor. And this was the same floor as the courtroom. So I went into the courtroom, sat down, just kind of waiting for what was next. And they took Kevin back into a room behind the courtroom. It's just like a wall separating the courtroom and the judge's chambers. And he met with his court-appointed attorneys.
As you know from the beginning of this episode, the courtroom would shortly go into lockdown. Liz explains.
Next thing I know, the sheriff's deputies are yelling at everyone, get down, get down. And people are running, doors are being slammed. Everyone was terrified. It was because the families of these little girls were in there, that these little girls were taken from this family at a very young age. And it was almost like reliving all this nightmare over again. Of, you don't know what he's capable of. You don't know what he's going to do next. You don't know what he's thinking. All we know is he's this dangerous man, and we're confined in a courtroom, a very small room with him. And so it scared everyone. And you can even the sheriff's deputies that are here to serve and protect us, you could tell they were on edge. I had no clue what was going on. I didn't know if he broke free and I didn't know what he was capable of. That was what I remember. I remember sitting in that courtroom in one of the back benches and all this kind of madness going on. And I'm thinking, oh my God, please God, help me. Like, what is going on? I hope I am not harmed. Because at the time we didn't know. I just kept thinking, did he break free and now he's going to get a gun? That's what my initial thinking was. Like, he's running the hallway and he's going to pick up a gun from one of these law enforcement members, and I don't know what's next.
Thankfully, that didn't happen. But instead, Kevin had attacked his own attorney, Peter Astor.
What happened was he smuggled in a blade, like a blade that you would put on maybe an X-Acto knife or something. He smuggled in one from jail. I don't know how he got it. And he was back meeting with his attorneys, and he decided to take the blade out and start cutting his attorney's throat. So that's what happened.
Luckily, the cut wasn't that deep, and his attorney survived. But he didn't attend the sentencing, saying that he didn't want the blood on his shirt to influence the judge. And so the sentencing hearing finally began. After everyone had gathered in the courtroom, Judge Parrish began by saying, quote, "Today is judgment day. Do you have any legal cause or reason why judgment should not be withheld?" Kevin handed a note to the judge. It read, in part, "I'm withdrawing my plea because the primary reason I entered my plea was so I could speak to the FBI about possible crimes committed by the OSBI, and because of the FBI's lack of finding, I'm wanting to withdraw. If the state is confident in their cases, they got nothing to worry about." Judge Parrish clarified with Kevin that he was now wishing to withdraw his pleas, and Kevin said yes. "You're not going to be able to do that at this time," Judge Parrish responded, saying that that would be dealt with at a separate hearing. The sentencing continued. Kevin was sentenced to life in prison without parole for each of the murders, and as each sentence was read, people in the courtroom began to clap. Ashley's parents both wrote victim impact statements about Ashley and how the loss of her has been a nightmarish trauma inflicted on their lives. Ashley's stepmom's statement started by saying, quote, "I hate what you did to all of the victims, having thoughts of just your own selfish, centered, demonic acts." It then cited a poem called "The Hunter Has Hunted," where the last line reads, "The hunter has hunted. This can't be true. Life was callously discarded like trash." Ashley's father's statement read, in part, "As with all parents, even after their children are grown, Ashley always has been and always will be my little girl. To completely articulate how Ashley's death has affected my life would be impossible. Just sitting down to write this is extremely painful. Some of my fondest memories of Ashley occurred when she was a child, watching her race around hunting Easter eggs, the smile and excitement on her face on Christmas morning, sitting down and watching cartoons with her as she told me about each and every character, reading her stories at bedtime and having her correct me if I changed it in any way, the look she gave me one morning when I was heading out to go deer hunting, having her point her finger at me and telling me that I was not allowed to hunt Bambi or Bambi's mother. The look on her face the time a giraffe stuck his head in the car and she fed it by hand. How she would crawl into my lap and hug me tightly around the neck when she was tired and ready for a nap. And my favorite memory of all, the first time I laid eyes on her, the day she was born." I couldn't find the victim impact statements from Taylor or Skyla's families, but they did talk to numerous reporters about the two little girls and who they were. Skyla's family said she liked to ride her bicycle down dirt roads and that wherever she went, her many cats followed, along with her pet goat. Skyla had dreams of becoming a veterinarian one day. And it was said that Taylor liked to rescue turtles she would find in the middle of the road and that she wanted to be a forensic scientist, much like the ones she saw on TV shows. All three victims had their lives ahead of them when they were killed. A week after Kevin's sentencing, Kevin was back in court, this time under heavy security, fighting to have his pleas withdrawn and for the chance at a jury trial. He took the stand for over an hour, saying that he had been forced to take the guilty pleas and that his attorneys had told him that he was going to get convicted no matter what. He also made a bizarre accusation that the OSBI had dressed up someone to look like him in the police interviews. His request to withdraw his pleas was denied. But less than 2 months later, Liz got a phone call in the middle of the night. Not from Kevin, but about Kevin.
In Oklahoma, you can sign up for alerts for inmates. And our station had signed up for an alert on Kevin. And I was woken up by my station at about 3 to 4 in the morning one night, them calling me back to back. And they said, "We got an alert on Kevin Sweat, and it says he is free. It says he is out." And they just were trying to come up with a plan. "Do we bring you to the station so we know you're safe? Do we call police and get them out to your house?" They didn't know exactly what was going on. They just knew we need to call Liz because this isn't maybe the safest situation, the safest scenario. And what ended up we found out after a few hours of research is there was some kind of clerical error when he was being transferred from jail to prison, to Oklahoma prison, to start his sentencing. And during that time lapse, during that lapse of time, over, you know, maybe an hour to 2 hours when he was getting transferred, when he was still under law enforcement observation, they marked him as free, as out.
The alert service, called Vine, is supposed to alert family members and victims when convicted criminals are released from prison. The service had sent the alert in error, but it was enough to cause not only Liz panic, but Kevin's victims' families as well. Ashley's mom told reporters that she was scared to death and that she was afraid for their lives. Everyone was relieved, however, to find out that Kevin was still behind bars, where he is scheduled to be for the rest of his life. I asked Liz, based on her conversations and her experience with him, to describe Kevin as a person.
I feel like the only way I could explain Kevin Sweat as a person is unpredictable and untrustworthy. You have no clue what he's capable of. You have no clue what he's saying is true or false. You have no clue what he's going to do next or what he's scheming of doing next.
Liz told me that this case has no doubt had an effect on her and that she's learned a lot from covering it.
How it affected me was people who have done bad acts, bad things in their life, you don't want to get wrapped up in speaking to them. You don't want to talk to them. Even though he was calling me, like I just think I've learned, it made me unsettled as a person. I felt like I was always on edge. So I think just the way it's impacted me is I don't really have any desire to answer any prisoners' phone calls anymore. And I think sometimes it's kind of hard for me to vocalize all of this. Like, I'm typically a better speaker than this, but there's a few factors. Like, it was many years ago. And because of all of this stuff that's happened, I think I just kind of put up a wall and moved on. Like, I just kind of blocked it out.
And that's all for this episode. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. What do you make of Kevin Sweat, and why do you think he was so eager to talk to Liz from prison? Let me know by visiting my Court Junkie discussion group, which you can get to by going to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And before I go, a couple announcements for you. I recently did an interview with the podcast Podcasts We Listen To with Jeremy Collins that I'd love for you to check out. As you know, I don't really talk about myself much, so if you're interested, Jeremy gets some personal details out of me, including why I decided to start this podcast, what some of the most emotional cases were for me to cover, and some other good stuff. That's the Podcasts We Listen To podcast. I also want to let you know that I'll be taking a break over the Christmas holidays. I'll be releasing one more episode on December 11th, and then Court Junkie will be on hiatus until January 8th. I promise, though, I'll still be working on the next batch of episodes, and you can also still reach me through my social channels or email. And lastly, I know that some of you aren't fans of the ads in these episodes, so if you would like to hear ad-free episodes, and you'd like to hear them earlier than everyone else, you can go to courtjunkie.com/support, and if you donate as little as $1 a month to this podcast, you'll get an exclusive ad-free feed for your podcast app, or you can listen ad-free online. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.